The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and as one who has made his living in some form of the book trade for the past 30 years, I was excited when I read about the publication of Robert Darnton's new book, A Literary Tour de France, The World of Books on the Eve of the French Revolution. Books about books are almost categorically fascinating to read. Perhaps that's a professional bias, and Mr. Darnton's certainly fills the bill. Interestingly, the author seems to have come full circle in this 50-year labor of love that, in some way, harkens back to his PhD thesis as a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, where he wrote about trends in radical propaganda on the eve of the French Revolution. Except that tonight we might substitute literature for propaganda, although, as we know, the two are not always mutually exclusive. During the course of his career, Robert Darnton has written numerous books on manifold topics, including the Great Cat Massacre and other episodes in French cultural history, The Business of Enlightenment, The Case for Books, The Devil in the Holy Water, or The Art of Slander from Louis XIV to Napoleon, and Censors at Work, How States Shaped Literature. His significant and sundry honors include a MacArthur Genius Grant, election to the French Legion of Honor, a National Humanities Medal, and a National Book Critics Circle Award. In A Literary Tour de France, the University Librarian Emeritus of Harvard University maps the rollicking, occasionally dangerous trails and travails of the men and women associated with the French publishing industry during that country's time of great upheaval. Please welcome Robert Darnton.
Well, thank you very much for that embarrassing introduction, Andy, but I'm delighted to be here. It's a great library. I think you are probably book lovers, and that's my subject, the subject of books, books actually as they existed 250 years ago in France. Now, the subject may seem, well, arcane, esoteric, but it isn't. It has to do with the power of the printed word to infiltrate and saturate a society on the eve of the first great revolution in modern times. So it's not just an interesting subject, it is an important one. And I thought I'd tell you a little bit about how I got into it. 52 years ago, I walked into a historian's dream, a collection of 50,000 letters in a tiny Swiss library that had gone virtually unseen by anyone for 250 years. These were letters by everyone who had anything to do with books. Authors, of course, publishers, yes, booksellers, lots of them, but even the workers who pulled the bar of the press, the men who made the ink, the paper makers, the smugglers, the wagon drivers, absolutely everyone. It was a whole world that lived from producing and distributing books. And it was a fascinating world because when you read your way through these 50,000 letters, the people came alive. Some of them had dossiers of 100 to 200 letters. You could follow their lives, even though it was business correspondence. You could find out when they had an apprenticeship, set up shop, got married, were widowed, or died, leaving the bookshop to their sons, or sometimes even to their daughters. The role of women is very important. This was a whole kind of Balzacian world, a human comedy, as Balzac would have called it, that I found just endlessly fascinating. So I began to read these letters in 1965, and this was before computers, etc. So as I had a pile of manuscripts in front of me, I would take notes on a little index card, put the index cards into shoe boxes, pile up the shoe boxes, and then somehow try to make history out of it all. Well, I've done a series of books and articles, and I worked on other subjects as well, but now I'm trying to draw it all together in this volume called A Literary Tour de France. Now, imagine reading 50,000 letters. You get lost in them. It's a whole ocean of human experience, and it's easy to go under, glug, 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 because there's so much of it. And that's a problem if you're trying to bring it all together in one volume, such as this one. So my way of trying to do justice to the richness of the sources, and at the same time tell a story that would interest an ordinary educated reader, is first of all to create a website. So this is the first page of the website. It's Robert Darnton, one word, .org. And you're welcome to use it anytime, it's free. There I could put a lot of the documents in French, many of them translated, and provide a lot of background information. So I did not feel compelled in writing the book to, you know, drown the reader in detail. I wanted the read to be fun. And so as a kind of thread, a narrative thread, to take the reader through all of this material and to, I hope, make it come alive, I decided to follow the trail of a sales rep or traveling bookseller. His name was Jean-François Fabergé. He got on a horse in July 1778, and he spent 5 months going all around France, visiting every bookshop on his path. That was his path. These are the main stops. So you see, he covered a lot of territory. And he didn't just try to sell books. Really, he was a kind of industrial spy. He gave reports on all of the booksellers, the nature of their business, the kind of clientele that they tried to satisfy, and especially whether they would pay their bills of exchange on time. It has some economics, it has some literature, it has lots of sociology, if you like. It's an ideal study. And when, after 5 months on the horse, this fellow Fabergé returned to Neuchâtel in Switzerland, which is up there in the upper right, he knew more about the world of books than any historian could ever hope to know. So what I want to do is to tap Fabergé's street-level understanding of the world of books and then to combine it with other kinds of documents, including the correspondence of the booksellers, which range over 20 years from 1769 to 1789. And then we'll have, so to speak, a horizontal view of this world, the bookseller's view, and a vertical view, which is the fat dossiers of letters from each of the booksellers. So there's a lot that you can find out by following him around France. We have his diary. I have his diary. I mean, imagine having the diary of a sales rep in the year 1778. He also wrote regular reports and received mail back from the Home Office, which, as I'll explain, is a publisher wholesaler in Neuchâtel, Switzerland. So you have both sides of the correspondence. And then there are the 50,000 letters of the booksellers and others. So it's an enormously rich and fascinating source. And in fact, the diary has at its end his expense account. That's what it looks like. You see, I don't assume you can read this, but just get a sense of the documentation. You'll see the names of cities and then his quick report on each of the booksellers in the cities. And here is his expense account, and it makes actually fascinating reading. For example, he spent 10 sous for refurbishing his pistols in Marseille. Why? Well, the silk workers in Lyon had run out of jobs, and they took to highway robbery, so he had to be armed when he traveled through the south of France. He spent 26 livres for new breeches, culottes, in La Rochelle. Why? Because the friction in the saddle wore through his old pants. And then he spent 8 louis, which is quite a lot of money, for a new horse in Loudun. Why? Well, the old horse just couldn't make it anymore. The first part of the journey was very hot. He traveled with one redingote, a riding coat as it's known, but he strapped it to the back of the saddle with his sample books and so on. And the horse was parched, but then when he got near Bordeaux, it rained and rained and rained. The horse slipped on the mud. Its horseshoes kept falling off. It developed great swellings in its legs. It collapsed constantly. And finally, it just couldn't take it anymore, and he then had the problem of selling a horse in alien territory. After all, he was Swiss, they were French, and they probably couldn't be trusted if you had to bargain over horse flesh. So there's lots of information in the letters about the difficulties of being a sales rep with a horse. When he finally arrived back, he was on a new horse, and there was a kind of reunion with a lot of local wine, and now the publisher bookseller was fully informed about this vast marketplace for books. So that was that is the basic idea of this book I myself have just written, a literary Tour de France, the world of books in the 18th century. So I want to pause at each of Fabergé's stops and to tell a little story about each city on the way, but moving fast in a kind of picaresque fashion so that you, the reader, enjoy the trip. And then if you're curious and want more information, you can go to my website, which I'll show you in a minute in more detail. But basically, I think it's, I hope it's a good read. So let me give you an example of how I tried to combine an account of one of his stops with some general remarks about one aspect of the world of books. And that concerns his first stop in the city of Pontarlier. So here's Neuchâtel. You don't quite see it. It's the Lake of Neuchâtel. But it's right up here. And he came through this valley. And here's a border between France and Switzerland. Now, this valley begins here in what the Swiss call the Trou de Bourgogne, the hole of Burgundy. These are actually quite steep mountains, the Jura Mountains, that run sort of from northeast to southwest. And so there are only certain passages through them. When he got to this border, he moved into French territory, which meant he became under the sovereignty, the control of the King of France. France is Catholic, he's Protestant, France is monarchical, he's from a sort of little republic in Switzerland. He's in real foreign territory, and so are the books, because the publisher called the Société Typographique de Neuchâtel, Typographical Society of Neuchâtel, which I abbreviate as STN, this publisher published everything that the French wanted to suppress. And it the entire Enlightenment, for example, but lots of really wicked books like The Private Life of Louis XV. A wonderful book in four volumes that told all about the king's sex life, but also gave you a very good inside account of French history throughout the entire reign, from 1715 to 1774. It was a big bestseller, and there were many others like it. In fact, I'll open a parenthesis. I was looking at one of the exhibitions we had at Harvard, and I saw an English translation of The Private Life of Louis XV. I didn't know there had been a translation, and then I looked harder. And on the upper right-hand corner of the title page was the word G. Washington. The father of our country was reading this trash, and so were a lot of other people. These were the books that the French loved and that the Swiss publisher wholesalers made a fortune in producing. So to get these books into France from Switzerland, they had to smuggle them. And they smuggled them in many different places in different ways. But one was right here at this border. Here is the town of Les Verrières. And there were peasants there who lived as smugglers. In fact, a lot of the population in this part of Switzerland, they smuggled everything, watches, cheese, and books. Smuggling was not an easy thing to do. Essentially, these peasants backpacked books. The packs usually weighed 60 pounds, and they couldn't go through the main road here. Instead, they had to cross mountain passes, and to avoid, there was a kind of patrol of the border guards, armed border guards. In fact, the word for smuggling in the 18th century among the book people was not smuggling, contrebande, it was assurance, insurance, because it was a highly organized industry, and there were real insurers who hired peasants to backpack the books across these mountain paths, and to get them to secret storehouses in France. Now, if, in fact, the peasants were caught by one of these flying squadrons who patrolled the border, the peasants would be thrown into jail, then branded on the right shoulder with the letters G-A-L for galérien, or galley slave, and then sent to row in the galleys for 9 years. The insurer, meanwhile, who was a kind of bourgeois entrepreneur, would repay the STN for the value of the books. So it was a real insurance operation, and on the whole, it worked very well. So I've calculated profit margins and gone into the economics of it. But it makes fascinating reading. Fabergé, when he arrived at Pontarlier, just in France, had a long discussion with the main smuggler of the STN, a man called Ignace Fèvre, and they worked out sort of new conditions. They bargained over a new contract, and in fact, I have the contract itself. I mean, imagine having the contract of a book smuggler from the 18th century. The contract said that Fèvre would get the books into France, quote, at my peril and risk for 15 livres, that's the currency of the time, per hundredweight. In case of any unhappy event, événement fâcheux, I will reimburse the value of the merchandise within 1 year according to the prices on the bill of lading, end quote. So you see what I mean. It's a real serious business, and this particular smuggler has 104 letters in his dossier. Well, historians have never run across actual original letters by smugglers, but here you can reconstruct the activity in wonderful, glorious detail. So that's the subject of the first stop, the first chapter and the first stop of Fabergé as he goes around France. But he has many other stops, many other jobs. In Marseille, for example, he warned his boss, the publisher, the STN, that Marseille was a tough town. In fact, there was a local book inspector who worked in the police, and he was one of these men, I'm quoting, who, in order to have meat on his plate, would eat his brother, end quote. So he's a real tough cop, and you had to smuggle the books in Marseille even after you had got them past the French border. So we have another more and more chapters about different variations on smuggling. But the interesting thing of Marseille, and I'll just give you this one example, is that there was a kind of war among the booksellers. The big fish were in the process of eating the little fish. And the biggest fish of all was a man called Jean Mussy, a very interesting entrepreneur who started off low in the hierarchy of traders and fought his way up and became the largest, most powerful bookseller in Marseille, which was the third largest city in France. So he was in the process of expanding his market share, his empire, while one of the characters on the bottom was in the middle of disappearing, getting devoured by this Mussy. The name of this small fish was Caldeseg. And when Fabergé arrived in Marseille, so that's, well, he looked into the disaster that was left by the collapse of the book trade of this character, Caldeseg. Now, Caldeseg I found quite interesting because I was able to reconstruct a lot of his career. So again, we're dealing with, a quite obscure person, but one can get to know his life through his letters and through letters about him by his neighbors and bill collectors and so on, so you have a fairly complete picture of him. His story actually begins with a love story. He wins the daughter of a well-off carpenter. She has a dowry. They invest the dowry in setting up a bookshop. And they start ordering books from Neuchâtel. They come down the Rhine. He stocks the shop with books. He sells them. But then his bills become due. So a shipment arrives. You send off a bill of exchange. It's like a promissory note, which becomes due in 12 months. And he keeps sending these promissory notes, and they're piling up. And soon, Caldeseg hasn't sold enough books locally to be able to pay off the bills of exchange. He panics. He packs several cases with his books, piles them onto a ship, and disappears to Spain, where he sells as many of the books as he can, while his wife goes back to her father with what is left, there's not much of it, of her dowry. And they get what is called a separation of bodies and goods. There was no divorce in the 18th century, but you could separate, so to speak, and her father began to look after her. But then Caldeseg, from Cadiz, thinks it over. One, he rather liked his wife. Two, he wasn't really happy in Spain. And three, he wanted to somehow resume his commerce. So he gets back on a ship, he goes into hiding, he woos his wife, he fences with his father-in-law, and he tries to cut a deal with his creditors. So there are lots of letters in which he attempts to piece together this trade that had fallen apart. The result is another disaster. He can't do it, and he simply disappears for good. So his neighbors, the bill collectors, all say, he's gone. That's the end of him. We'll never see him again. That's like many other dossiers that end in the same way. And there is the most common phrase is, left the keys under the door. But there are other phrases. Went to Russia. Joined the army to fight in America. I'm trying to think of some more. His wife and children are begging at the entrance to the church. There was no limited liability in the 18th century. If you were in trade and you couldn't pay your bills, you would go to debtor's prison or run for it. So I found this happening again and again and again. And if you've, I don't know how much Balzac you've read, but my favorite novel of Balzac is Lost Illusions, Illusion Perdue, in which Balzac describes exactly this world as it existed in the 1820s and 30s, when Balzac knew it intimately. And I am convinced that it was more or less the same world in the 1770s and 1780s. So I'm developing a kind of Balzacian approach, if you like, to history. So there are lots of sort of human stories behind this general issue of how books penetrated into the society of the old regime during the 20 years before the French Revolution. Let's go back one, and you can have a simpler view of the overall route of Fabergé. In the year 1910, a very grand professor at the Sorbonne published an article, What Did the French Read on the Eve of the French Revolution? His name was Daniel Mornay, and he thought he found a way to answer that question, which he had been the first to ask in a serious, systematic way. He had found 500 catalogs of private libraries that were put up for auction. And he, you know, they were quite detailed catalogs. He went through all 500 of them, counted all the titles, had a table of statistics, and in the table, how many copies of Rousseau's Social Contract do you think he found? 500? No, the answer is one. One copy of the book that was supposed to be the Bible of the French Revolution. So Mornay said, tear up the textbooks. They've got it all wrong. Nobody read the most democratic treatise on political thought before 1789. We have to rethink the whole question of the ideological origins of the French Revolution. Now, it turned out that, unfortunately, Mornay had made a mistake. He didn't know that printed catalogs had to be censored. So, by definition, the Enlightenment and seditious literature was missing from the very source that he consulted, and one of the censors missed one copy of Rousseau's Social Contract. So his conclusions don't hold up, but the question does. And what I want to do this evening is to answer that question. Now, I hope that I'm not going to make any mistake as bad as Mornay's, but you may catch me in one. So I'd like to spend the rest of the time not talking really about all of these booksellers, even though there's a very interesting story behind each of them, but rather talking about what literary demand actually was. So if you go to my website, you can take one of the points on the map, click on it. In this case, it's the city of Besançon, and then begin to follow a trail that you yourself can make through all of the material. First, you will see a contemporary engraving of the city, and then you will get a summary of the main institutions, the literacy rate, the cultural life of that particular place. If you're more interested, you can click further, and I write a little monograph about the city of Besançon. And then down below, you can look at the two booksellers, and go to their correspondence. Here is the background information. You click here, and you get a quick sketch of a bookseller called Charmé. And then if you are interested enough, you can read a little monograph that I write about him and about his business. This is an example of a transcription of one of his letters. He has 179 letters, wonderful letters. And that's what they look like. They didn't really have, envelopes in the 18th century. You folded the paper and waxed it. And this is what a typical letter looks like. So you go through enough of these, and soon you get a pretty good idea of his trade and even of his characters. So I then, these letters are ordering books from the supplier, the STN. And I count every single order and draw up a table of statistics showing you exactly how many copies and what dates he ordered all of these books. I arrange it alphabetically. And then I do a bestseller list for him. So these are the books that he ordered most often. Now, I don't expect you can read all these titles or that you're familiar with them, but this is to give you some idea of the ambition of this research. That's one bookseller, and I took 18 of the most important booksellers scattered around French, developed statistics from their orders, and came up with a general table of all of the books. There were 1,145 titles. I arranged them all alphabetically from A to Z, and this shows you exactly who bought them and on what date. And then it became possible to construct a retrospective bestseller list and to find out what books were most in demand out of 1,145 titles, which is really all of the books that were circulating in pre-revolutionary France. Now, these lists and more provide an answer to Mornay's question, I think. But I bet you might have some doubts. Have I myself made some methodological flaw? After all, this is it's a fabulous collection of documents. There's nothing like it anywhere in Europe or this country. But it's a small keyhole, this tiny city of Neuchâtel, through which to see the entire book trade of France. So are these sources representative? Now, I will quickly try to answer that question, which is no doubt your doubt about the whole enterprise. First, you should know that supply and demand could not operate freely on the French market, and that because of three things. Censorship, every book that appeared legally had to pass through an elaborate censorship. The monopoly of the Parisian Booksellers Guild. We could talk more about that if you like, but there was a very powerful guild that produced all the legal literature in France to the exclusion of provincial publishers and printers. And three, there were special inspectors of the book trade who went around confiscating any illegal books. So you couldn't really publish a great deal that challenged the orthodox values of the old regime within this system. You publish these books outside of France. And France is, in fact, surrounded by what I call a fertile crescent of publishing houses that run from Amsterdam to Brussels and Liège and through the Rhineland into Switzerland at Basel and Bern and Lausanne and Geneva and especially Neuchâtel. But of all of these dozens of publishing houses, The only archives that have survived are these in Neuchâtel. So they're really very important if you want to answer some fundamental questions, such as that of Daniel Mornay. Now, these foreign publishers produced almost the entire French Enlightenment, but they also produced a lot more works that weren't great works of philosophy, but a good deal of pornography and libelous, seditious material, such as The Private Life of Louis XV, or anecdotes about Madame du Barry. They were terrific reads, and they made the French monarchy look bad. Furthermore, they pirated everything that sold in France. They even had agents that furnished them with information and got early copies of the books. And as soon as they heard a book was selling, they would start putting it into print. So there is a fascinating world of piracy in which everyone is rushing to the market, there's no copyright, and so it's a kind of wild west of publishing that makes fascinating reading. Now, no historian really has been able to get inside the operations of these publishers because these documents simply weren't available except in this one place, Neuchâtel. But I want to answer that the Neuchâtel archives are, up to a point, representative of the trade as a whole. And I think I can do that, I'll just move fast, by putting two questions which I think have never been asked. How did publishers publish books, and how did booksellers buy them? You know that the greatest sin among historians is anachronism. That is, we project on the past our notions from the present. Publishing in the 18th century was very different from what publishing is today. There was no copyright, and there were no returns. So a bookseller, if he fails to sell the books that he orders, cannot send them back and get reimbursed. When I say this to publishers today, they say, oh, it must have been paradise. Because often, when a book is published, 40% or more of the copies sent out to bookshops are returned at a great loss to the publisher. Well, there are other differences as well. I don't have time to go into them all. But for example, if you published a book at a typical press run, about 1,000 copies, you were worried that other publishers would pirate the same book and get to the market before you did. There is a large risk involved. So you minimize the risk by trading of the 1,000 copies, 100 or 200 or 300 copies with another allied publisher. And in return, you get the equivalent value in books that you choose from his stock. And that means that you are building up your own stock through constant trading, and a bookseller publisher automatically becomes a wholesale dealer. Wholesaling and publishing are inseparable along this fertile crescent. And therefore, books ordered from this publisher represent the entire corpus of books that were available at that time. And the STN actually indicated this at many points. Its catalog from 1785 had 700 titles in it. It did an inventory of its warehouse in 1787 and came up with 1,500 different titles, lots of copies of each one. In 1773, it wrote a letter to a bookseller saying, quote, "No book of any merit appears in France that we are not capable of providing," end quote. So they are providing the virtual totality of the literature at the time. And if you study the orders, those orders to the STN represent the demand for literature in general, not just for the books published by the STN. Secondly, how did booksellers order books? Well, as I said, there were no returns, and so they were careful. They didn't want to order many copies of a particular title. However, the cost of transport was a very important factor. If the books have to go all the way from Neuchâtel, several hundred miles, to Bordeaux or Marseille. And so it turns out that the transport costs were much cheaper if the case in which the books were shipped weighed more than 50 pounds. Less than 50 pounds, the books had to go by coach rather than by wagon. And the distinction between coach and wagon and the 50-pound limit is absolutely crucial to the strategy of ordering books, because you needed enough weight to benefit from the cheaper transportation rates. Now, they didn't order many copies of a single work, but they ordered lots of different works. So the orders to the SDN also demonstrate the general stock that the booksellers were building up. Do you follow me? You get virtually all the books available from Neuchâtel, and the orders are for the whole spectrum of literature that the bookseller wanted to sell. And therefore, if you carefully study the development of a bookseller's trade over 20 years, you get a quite accurate idea of what the trade actually was, what literary demand was. So, what were the best sellers of pre-revolutionary France? Here you see them listed, and you can't read the titles at that distance, so don't worry about that. I just wanted you to have a look at the list, which goes on for 31 different titles. But there are basically four characteristics that I think stand out. First of all, there was a heavy demand for scandalous works like The Private Life of Louis XV, and they made the monarchy look bad. It was, you know, scandalous stories, but they take you inside Versailles, the corridors of power, and show you how despicable these people actually were. Now, they weren't despicable. This is libelous literature, but it was also very good reading. Secondly, you see the penetration of the works of the Enlightenment. Now, not so much abstract treatises. A lot of the works were popularized Enlightenment tracts. The one that is the number two bestseller on the list is, here it's number three. I also included Protestant works, but of course the French are Catholic, so you have to discount for that. This is a book called The Year 2440. It was a terrific bestseller. It's the first utopian novel set in the future, not in some geographically remote place. And it describes Paris in the year 2440 as an ideal society. Very interesting. There's no technology. You know, our utopias are all about spaceships and so on. No, zero technology. It's all about virtue. The citizens are virtuous. They have gardens on top of their houses because they want to be close to nature. The general will rule society, et cetera, et cetera. It's very sentimental. It's very Rousseauistic. Some of the other Enlightenment tracts included atheistic works. That surprised me that atheism sold so well. I think it was a lot of it had to do with shock value, but I found a great deal of it. And of course, a lot of Voltaire and Rousseau. But it was the Voltaire of La Pucelle d'Orléans, the Joan of Arc, which is a very scurrilous and funny anti-clerical fake poem, long poem. So that's the second category. The third are educational and utilitarian works, a popular manual on grammar by Pierre Restaud, a French-Latin dictionary. Lots of books about health and how to watch your own health. And then a fourth category of light fiction, which is often amusing and spicy. The Perverted Peasant by Rétif de la Bretonne, and Stern's Sentimental Voyage, which was a big hit in French. Now, if you add to these bestsellers a strong dose of history, history sold well, especially the works of William Robertson, translated into French, and Claude-François Xavier Millot, and also adventurous travel books, Cook's Travels Around the World, La Pérouse, Bougainville. If you put all that together, you will have, I think, a very good view of the literary diet of the French. That is, works that were actually in demand on the literary marketplace and works that the French actually consumed, whatever it means to consume a book. I mean, the history of reading is another whole subject. So, now comes the big question, and I don't have a great answer for it, but this is the best I can do. What was the connection between this corpus of literature, the literary demand, as I've described it, on the one hand, and the French Revolution on the other? Well, of course, you can't make a linear causal argument that goes from the printing of a book to the sale of the book to the reading of the book by an individual to the collective attitudes of the French to action, the storming of the Bastille. I mean, that's a very extravagant line of reasoning, and it won't work. So I think there are three main tendencies that deserve underlining. First of all, this deep penetration of the Enlightenment, as I mentioned, and the Enlightenment is a complex movement, so there are many aspects of it that were actually penetrating into French society. Secondly, what you could call the delegitimation of the monarchy. Louis XV is portrayed as an ordinary person, in fact, as a dirty old man. Louis XVI is utterly incompetent and impotent. He had great trouble producing an heir to the throne. The theme is decadence and despotism. That is, I think, a master theme that runs through this literature. And then thirdly, this sounds a little far-fetched maybe, but I think there was a sort of reconfiguring of reality, or what I call possibilism. That is, the sense that things as they are don't have to be things as they ought to be. And if you take this utopian novel, Paris in the year 2440, and read it in comparison with another bestseller by the same author, Louis-Sébastien Mercier, called The Tableau de Paris, the View of Paris, the utopian novel, that's the way the world ought to be. The View of Paris is full of the most excruciating suffering and pain and cruelty. So I think that the French began to develop the idea that you didn't have to live with the world as it was organized then, that there was another possible world. They didn't decide they were going to rise in revolution until lots of other factors occurred, which made, like the price of bread, which made possible street violence and then the transformation of the political order. So I think that there is relevance between this seemingly esoteric research on reading habits and the world of books on the one hand and political history on the other. That's my thesis, but I now welcome your questions.
Thank you, Robert, for that presentation. We've got about 10 minutes for questions. Yes, start us off here on the left. There's a mic right behind you.
Thank you, Professor, very much for presenting to us that fascinating story. There's another fascinating story that's hiding behind the one that you talked about, and I'm actually just as interested in that one, and that is the story of your encountering these books at the beginning of your career and then writing about them much later. And there are a number of books that you probably know them, Patrick Leigh Fermor's book, A Time of Gift, that in which an author goes back to discovers texts that he had found 50 years before and then writes about them. I was curious to know why you didn't write about them then and what it's like to go back to that topic now.
Well, I have to admit I've written a lot of articles and books that draw on these sources. And so I've argued a series of theses which have stirred up some debate, and there are polemics surrounding all this, so it isn't as innocent as it may sound. One of them was the importance of pornography, actually, as an ingredient in French literary culture. Some other historians, Elizabeth Eisenstein, for example, a very fine historian, really objected to this and felt it was a way of sort of denigrating the Enlightenment. I mean, that's not my idea at all, but it was a little offensive. And if you read some of these books, they're pretty raw, although the concept of pornography and the word itself did not exist in the 18th century. It's a different kind of Gallic spirit, if you like, that goes back to Rabelais. So I have been developing arguments and discussing this in a series of other articles and so on, but now I'm trying to bring it all together. And I can tell you how I got into this in the first place, trying to answer your question. So I was a graduate student in Oxford, and I came upon a footnote. Now, I was interested in the French fascination with America and this new republic. There were all kinds of things going on in France, and including something called a Gallo-American society, in which French people who were wacky in their love for America got together and discussed all sorts of interesting topics. And I did a sort of MA thesis on the Gallo-American society. One of its major figures was a character called Jacques-Pierre Brissot, who went on to become the head of the Girondist party in the French Revolution and was guillotined by Robespierre. Brissot actually traveled to the American colonies and, or now the new American Republic. He came to Philadelphia and so on. He was very interesting in that respect, and a footnote in one of the books that I happened to consult suggested there might be some letters of Brissot in this little municipal library in French Switzerland, Neuchâtel. So it cost the price of one stamp, and I wrote to the library, and I said, you know, do you possibly have any letters of Brissot? And by return mail, the director of the library said, yes, we have 119. Here's a photocopy of one of them. And the photocopy was simply amazing because it had enough information to transform one's understanding of Brissot's career. So one thing led to another, and I got a sort of postdoc at Harvard. So I went to the library as quickly as I could in order to write a biography of Brissot and read the other 118 letters. There they were, surrounded by the 50,000 other letters, because he published his work with the STN. So I started writing the biography, and I actually wrote 500 pages, which are sitting in a drawer somewhere, because I finally said, I mean, I wrote articles and got the main conclusions out, but I finally thought, you know, books, the history of books is more interesting than the biography of Brissot. So I published all of his letters and I wrote an article about it, but I then thought, no, do the history of books. And at that time, the word didn't even exist. It became quite well known in France around that time as Histoire du Livre, history of the book. Sounds awkward in English, history of the book. You know, people say, which book? Or history of books or book history. In German, it's quite a big discipline, Buchgeschichte or Geschichte des Buchwissenschaft. And it's now taken off in the US. So I found myself part of a broad attempt to do a new kind of history centered on the printed word.
Tell me, did you ever find who assembled the 50,000 books?
Yes. is how is it that this extraordinary archive in this little Swiss town, I don't know if any of you have ever been to Neuchâtel. I mean, it's not on the road to anything, really. But it's very beautiful. There's a lovely lake, the Jura Mountains in the background, they have vineyards. I spent 14 summers and one winter in these archives. And my children kind of grew up there in the summertime. They acquired a funny Jura accent in their French. How did that archive ever come to be? So imagine France surrounded by dozens and dozens of these publishing houses. They all throw away their archives. Publishers today throw away their archives. And the only thing they're interested in actually is, letters by famous writers. The account books are much more interesting than the letters of famous writers. You can see how things are really happening if you study the account books. So one of the partners, there were three main partners to the STN, was a very wealthy man called Bosset de Luz, and he owned a magnificent 18th century house that went down over terraces to the lake. I've been in the house, including the attic of the house, because that's where the papers of the STN were left. And they just sat in this attic for two centuries and more. And then the descendants fell on some hard times, and someone said, I think we've got something that might be valuable in the attic. So they went up, and sure enough, they found letters by Voltaire. So they started selling these letters. I mean, an unpublished letter of Voltaire, or just any letter of Voltaire, is rather valuable. The local town fathers heard about this. They took up a collection. They bought out the family, moved the papers into the basement of this library, which is maybe 1/100th of the size of your library, just a little sweet library on the edge of the lake. And then a retired chemist called Jean Prêtre, as a kind of hobby, cataloged these papers. He did a beautiful job. So you can go to any city, anywhere in Europe, but especially in France, and the catalog shows you exactly who wrote the letters, how many letters there are, etc. So you can work your way through it systematically. And it's an absolute treasure. But of course, it needed to be supplemented from other sources. So I spent a great deal of time, years and years, in Paris, where you have state archives, but the state had a special branch of the administration for controlling the book trade. That's how important it was. It was called the Direction de la Librairie. And not all of its archives have survived, but several thousand documents have. So I've spent years reading those documents and documents in other sources, provincial archives, bankruptcy letters, archives, which are very important. And the same persons often show up in all of them. So you see the same person viewed by the police or in his commercial correspondence and sometimes going bankrupt with his bankruptcy papers. As a result, you get a pretty three-dimensional or two-dimensional view of these people, and these are people who've never made it into history. So I find it thrilling, and in this book, I'm trying to bring them back to life.
It seems as though the book trade started out by, as you have explained, selling books. There were no libraries at this time, and when do libraries get into the book, the book trade?
Well, of course, libraries existed, but they existed largely in monasteries. They existed in royal collections and in universities. Now, in my university where I did my PhD, Oxford, all of the colleges had their own libraries. And for a while, I was a fellow in the College of All Souls, which was founded in 1438, before the invention of printing by movable type. So their collection is simply amazing. I mean, you could go through the collection and watch printing happen and so on and so on. So universities were great sources of libraries, but the libraries I don't know if you've been to Oxford or Cambridge, but in Oxford, the colleges have their own libraries, sometimes very great, surrounded by walls, which are 10 to 15 feet high. And on top of the walls, there are spikes that go up and bits, shards of glass stuck in, so that you can't, no, the outside can't get in and the inside can't get out after 10 o'clock at night. When I was a student in St. John's College, if I was staying in a pub after 10 o'clock, the only way in was to climb these walls. Now, there were special secret routes in and so on, but it wasn't easy. And my point is simply that these institutions which developed libraries turned their backs on the rest of the world. The public, it was not admitted. And my major mission as head of the Harvard University Library, which is the largest university library in the world, 20 million volumes, was to open it up to the world. But we couldn't let in anyone who wanted to come physically in there, or we would be overwhelmed. So we have digitized the collections in a major way, manuscripts as well as printed books. And we've created something called the Digital Public Library of America, which is now trying to combine in a single digital system the holdings of all the research libraries in this country. The Library of Congress did not participate, but it's beginning to participate. And we have more, I think it's 1,100 research libraries that have contributed to this digital database. So I think we're moving into a world where the totality of our cultural heritage will be available free of charge to all humans.
Professor Darton, how did the ancient regime's book police police the publishers of France? Did they have written guidelines for the French book publishers? How did it work?
So there is a, as I said, a branch of the royal bureaucracy called the Direction de la Librairie. That's where the censors work. They had lots of functions, including dealing with suits among booksellers and publishers, quarrels, and so on. And then there were special inspectors of the book trade. These had reported both to this branch of the administration and to the police. Now, the Parisian police are organized in 1667 as the most modern police force in the world. I mean, no one had ever imagine such an effective police force, and they recruited very intelligent people. So there was one person in particular who was the inspector of the book trade for Paris. And throughout most of the 18th century, he was a character called Joseph Desmarais. He had the right to raid any bookstore, just to walk in, often accompanied by a bailiff and some other armed police officers, to inspect the books, the account books, to see what books were on the shelves, what books were under the counter, to go into the back rooms, to just stake out the place completely. And if he found forbidden or pirated books, he would confiscate them. And then if it was really serious, he would have a lettre de cachet, a royal order, issued to take the bookseller into the Bastille. And there, sitting in a cell, you're never told why you're in the Bastille. You're in a cell, it's cold, there's no torture, but you sit there, and you sit there, and you sit there, and finally, after 5 or 6 days, you're interrogated. And the job of the inspector is to find out where you got your books, who printed them, to whom did you sell them, you know, to get the whole story. And these interrogations are wonderful documents. I've read many, many, many of them and spent months in the papers of the Bastille because they're written as an interrogation. Question, answer, question, answer. And at the bottom, the suspect signs his or her name, verifying the accuracy of the text. So this inspector of the police is a man of enormous knowledge and of quite an effective agent for trying to control the book trade. He also, Demery, was a very intelligent fellow. I'm publishing a lot of his writings, his letters, and he had a diary too. And he makes comments about the writers. He knew them all. And at one point, he had printed up forms for doing a census of every writer he could find in Paris. Between 1748 and 1752, he found 501 writers. They included Rousseau, Diderot, Voltaire, Montesquieu, all the famous writers, and then hundreds of writers that no one's ever heard of. So I've done a study of these reports to do a kind of sociology of authorship. And he makes comments on the people. One, the comment I liked best was about a writer. He said, well, he can handle prose pretty well, but he can't write a good Alexandrian in verse. Now, could you imagine a cop in Philadelphia commenting on the style of a suspect in his writing?
Thank you, Robert Darnton. What a pleasure and a privilege. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.